101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist. Good evening. On the program today, in national news, we'll be continuing our coverage of the recent prorogation of Parliament by bringing you an interview with Member of Parliament Libby Davies, who is the House Leader for the New Democrats. Also in national news, we'll bring you an interview with Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives economist Hugh McKenzie, who is the author of a recent published study on the compensation of the 100 highest paid CEOs in Canada. We'll also be bringing you a live interview with Steve Anderson of Save Our Net Coalition to discuss net neutrality in Canada and the recent announcement by the Liberal Party of Canada on the issue. And in local news, we'll bring you coverage of the five climate change activists who will no longer be charged for their sit-in at Conservative MP Andrew Saxton's constituency office in North Vancouver. We'll have all this plus your weekly health tip and your weekend weather forecast coming up on this hour here on News 101. It has been an interesting several weeks in Canadian politics as Prime Minister Stephen Harper has prorogued Parliament for the second time as Prime Minister, an action that many opposition MPs see as a strategic maneuver to avoid any discussion on the Afghan detainee torture issue. Andrew Longhurst brings us an interview to discuss the recent prorogation with Libby Davies, the NDP House Leader and Member of Parliament for Vancouver East.
What was your initial thought after it was announced that the Prime Minister had asked the Governor General to prorogue Parliament?
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous. There's no reason, there's no legitimate reason to have Parliament prorogued. This is entirely about their political agenda. And the thing that struck me was that he did it so early. I mean, the prorogation is bad itself, but the fact that they did it so early is even worse, and I think it's a very telltale sign of what's going on, because I've been an MP for 11-plus years, and I've gone through various prorogations with when Chrétien was the Prime Minister and so on, and usually they do it a few days before the session is to start, like a week before or something like that. And so it raises the question as to why he did it in December when we were meant to go back January 25th. And, of course, what the answer is, I think, because when you prorogue the House, the committees can't meet. And as you probably know, the whole issue around the detainees in Afghanistan and Canada's handling of the war in Afghanistan has been a huge issue, at least in Parliament. And I think more and more people are asking questions about it. And the committee, the Special Committee on Afghanistan, was meeting. They met before Christmas. So even when the House is recessed, committees can still meet, okay?
Right.
And but if you prorogue the House, they can't meet.
So this goes back to December when there was the committee meeting and Conservatives boycotted it, essentially.
Yes, and then they, but the committee was still active, and I think they were planning to call other meetings and try again, and the pressure would have been mounting from the media, and it would have been harder for the Conservatives to hold up the meeting. And so I think it's incredibly suspicious that he prorogued the House in December when the House wasn't set to come back until January the 25th, and so the consequence of that is that the committees now can't meet, any committee, and in particular this one.
Where does it leave the opposition parties looking after Parliament resumes following the games?
Well,
where does it leave Parliament with the detainee issue?
Well, it makes it much more difficult to get to the truth of what happened, right? You need the committee to do that. You need witnesses. You need to be able to do research to call, you know. Of course, we had a standoff when the House recessed because there was two motions. It was an NDP motion that passed to call for a public inquiry, and then there was a Liberal motion the day that the House recessed, basically calling on the government to produce all of the papers, and they refused to do that. And that was a very serious matter because the government is compelled to do that by Parliament. There's a difference between the government and Parliament, right?
Right.
So Parliament was compelling the government to produce those papers. It will make it a lot more difficult when the House is not sitting. There's no question period. There's no committees. the media isn't there every day. I mean, that doesn't mean the issue is going to go away, but it will make it more difficult to hold Stephen Harper to account. And I think that actually is the real story here is, you know, a lot of people feel very nervous about Stephen Harper and who he is and what he does and decisions that he's made. And I think people feel that at least in a minority parliament, he's held to account, right? That there's a majority of members represented in other parties who can vote against him. And we've done that on a number of occasions. Well, if parliament's not sitting, you've lost that, right? Like, where does that accountability come from if the parliament's not actually sitting? And so this guy's out there doing whatever he wants. So I think that is the real story here, that there's that we've lost this, you know, a huge amount of accountability and the ability to keep Stephen Harper, you know, under control. And I guess the third thing is the timing around the Olympics, right? I mean, we're in Vancouver. We've got the global media descending on Vancouver very shortly. What is it that he doesn't want them to know about Afghanistan and Canada's involvement there that he's trying to hold back, right? Because it's very suspicious that this is all, you know, all being done before the Olympics and suddenly Parliament shut down.
How do you feel when he's using the Olympics as a tool for his own partisan game?
Oh, it's completely, completely false. You know, all parties agree to what's called the House calendar, okay? It's set, months and months in advance. It's an all-party agreement. So the government agreed to the calendar that stated that when the Olympics were on, the parliament would be sitting 1 week, and 1 week we would be what we call a recess week, even though we would have come back, right? So there's a parliamentary calendar. When the House is sitting, like from, say, January to June, we usually sit 3 or 4 weeks in a row, and then we have what's called a skip week, and where we're back in our ridings, okay? And that's all worked out in advance. So the parliamentary calendar for this coming session would have started on January the 25th, and by prior agreement, including with the government, it was agreed that 1 week during the Olympic, the House would sit, and the other week we wouldn't. And there was huge discussion on that amongst the parties, and I know that because I'm the House leader for the NDP, and I'm involved in those discussions. So they agreed to it. So this whole thing, the Olympics are on, we have to cancel the House, is completely fake, because they had already previously agreed to the calendar, knowing full well that the Olympics were happening. In fact, there were specific discussions about it.
We had Liberal MP Hedy Fry on the program yesterday, and she said quite candidly that she unfortunately doesn't see this action by the Prime Minister and his party as translating into increased support for the opposition parties. Do you agree with that comment?
No, I think there is some momentum amongst some segments of society of people who are very, very upset about this. Like there's a Facebook group, right, that's been growing by the thousands. There's even people are beginning to organize rallies against the prorogation, which is unheard of. So I think that there's a growing body of opinion. I mean, you know, you get something like the Globe and Mail doing a front page editorial, right, slamming the government for shutting down the House of Commons. So I think it gets to a point where people say, okay, that's it, I've had it. Like, you know, this guy has just gone too far. And I do think that we're somewhere approaching that point where I think people feel this is very anti-democratic. It's done completely to suit his political agenda. It's completely, false in terms of these reasons they're giving that somehow they want to study how Canada will come out of the recession. I mean, all the more reason for Parliament to be meeting. I mean,
but constitutionally and legally, there's really nothing that opposition parties can do. Is that correct to say that?
It's a unilateral decision that he makes, and he goes to the Governor General, and she basically says okay. I mean, we don't know the conversation, but supposedly she said all right, that's fine. Well, I mean, there's still things happen politically. We're not in a vacuum. I have said it makes it more difficult to hold him to account without Parliament sitting, without question period, without the committees every day. But we're all not going to, you know, go hide in a rabbit hole and say, oh, well, we lost that one. Isn't that terrible? I mean, at least from the NDP's point of view, we will continue to mount every pressure that we can on the issue around the war in Afghanistan and the detainees and, you know, the issues generally around the economy and hold this guy to account. And we have our caucus retreat in Ottawa on January the 18th, and we're going ahead with that. We haven't canceled it. And I can tell you that within our caucus, there'll be a very active discussion about what we can do to continue to be out there holding this government to account. We're not going to let go of that.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Davies.
All right.
I appreciate the time.
No problem.
Take care now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you to Andrew Longhurst for bringing us that interview with NDP MP Libby Davies. It's now time for some public service announcement, but stay tuned for more national and local news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more totally free at LiveMusicVancouver.com.
When you first learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website, www.spec.bc.ca, for more information.
CITR is super popular. We've partnered with great local businesses to bring all our friends discounts in their communities. Say you like to kick it in kits. Show your friends of CITR card at Canterbury Tales Secondhand Books, Rufus's Guitar Shop, Prussian Music, The Eatery, Grindhouse Video, Fresh's Best Salsa & Co., Roy Shoes Limited, Vaz Boutique, Sage Natural Wellness, Gumdrops, Spank Shoes, Banyan Books, and the UBC Bike Kitchen, and save. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
Well, I want to be your old lover. I want to be your man. I want you to understand.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Neutrality, and why should you care about it? Net neutrality is one of the founding principles of the open internet, and it's the way the internet has always worked up to this point. And it basically means that all websites are created equal, whether you go to Google or Yahoo.
While many MPs are checking their schedules and contemplating a winter sans parliament, one Liberal MP gave net neutrality a show of support yesterday. Liberal MP Mark Garneau answered questions for the national campaign SaveOurNet.ca about the Liberal Party's support of open internet. On the phone, we have Steve Anderson, national coordinator of SaveOurNet.ca. Steve, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So earlier today, you said that the conservative government should join the other parties and support internet openness, and that the public knows which party is about to step with innovation, consumer choice, and free expression. Can you tell us a little bit about why you came out against the conservatives today?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've sort of been trying to engage with all the parties and encouraging them to support net neutrality and internet openness in general, and to, you know, create a real broadband plan for this country. And, you know, the NDP, especially with one of their MPs, Charlie Angus, have been really aggressive on these issues. They even put out a private member's bill supporting net neutrality. And as of late, the Liberals have been really aggressive on calling for net neutrality in Parliament as well. And this Q&A just kind of made it more concrete what their position is. And so it's just really, and the Green Party as well has also been out front of net neutrality since the get-go. And so it really is just the conservatives that they seem to be really vague on this issue. They haven't come out against internet openness, but they've sort of not really said anything to the contrary either.
And so you did also say that you hope the conservatives will take a position on the internet openness soon. You are hopeful, but as you mentioned, you know, this private member bill that was introduced now with the recently prorogued parliament, do you expect any feedback from the conservatives in the near future? As you've demonstrated, their history has been rather bleak in discussing this.
Yeah, I am cautiously optimistic in the longer term because I think that there is clearly momentum, and there's clearly pressure growing from a lot of different quarters for internet openness, and you know, whether it be consumer choice and free expression, or for even just like innovation and economic development and free entrepreneurship. There's a whole different diversity of groups and interests pushing for this, and you know, the conservatives, they haven't come out in favor of net neutrality, but what they have done is said that there is a need for a real digital strategy in Canada. And I mean, that may sound like a small move, but in the past, you know, I've been kind of trying to push them on this for a while. They basically said, like, there's no problem, and, you know, this is between telecom companies and their customers, and they just basically brushed it aside, whereas now they're saying, you know, there are issues here that need to be addressed. So, you know, they are, you know, moving, so that they're at least admitting that there's some issues at hand here.
Right.
And I think as the pressure grows, we can probably force them to you know, get a little bit more aggressive on these issues as well. Or, you know, or maybe they'll lose an election at some point and it won't matter.
And so maybe you could comment on the Q&A that you did have with Liberal MP Mark Garneau. Did you find that his answers on behalf of the Liberal Party were satisfactory to the questions that Save Our Net were proposing?
More or less. Like on some of the issues, they weren't as concrete or specific as I would want them to be. But, I mean, you know, they're not in power and they have a lot of things on their plate, so I understand. But, you know, there's some things like, you know, we asked them about, you know, a broadband plan and wholesale, you know, some more technical things on, like, wholesale and independent ISPs. And they basically said, like, you know, we need to have a broadband plan and there needs to be a more fair treatment of independent ISPs, but they weren't real specific on what exactly that would, you know, what exact policies they want to put forward there. But, you know, they were very clear on their support, and they did call out the conservatives on a few of their bad decisions, which is important. But in terms of net neutrality and internet opens, they were really specific on that, which is really great. Like, they did say, you know, that internet providers shouldn't be able to discriminate between online content and services. They shouldn't be slowing down or speeding up access to, for example, BitTorrent and things like that. And that's really important. So they basically said the internet should be a level playing field, and they believe that there should be a law that supports that. And they also took it a step further and said that even with in terms of people who access the internet on their cell phone, they should also be able to expect an open internet as well. And that's really important looking forward. It might not seem that important now, but more and more we're going to be using mobile phones to get the internet, and it's important that we kind of bake openness into that recipe, that access point. And so it's really good that the liberals are kind of pushing, they're actually pushing and advancing the openness of the internet beyond just PCs and towards the mobile access.
One piece that I did glean from that Q&A was when Liberal MP Mark Garneau brought up the initiative by the UK in terms of implementation. Could you foresee a similar plan being successfully implemented in Canada?
It's anything within the realm of possibility here. I think part of what they're alluding to is that the internet there, the backbone of the internet is a little bit more like a public utility, and independent ISPs are a little bit more free to provide open internet access, whereas in Canada, the big telecom companies sort of, they basically not only throttle their own access, their own customers, they also throttle competing companies who kind of use their network to get access to people. So like a company like TechSavvy, for example, is pretty well known because they were really in front of internet openness. They provided people unlimited downloads, complete access to the internet, and then they use Bell Canada's infrastructure in Ontario, and Bell started even blocking their access to certain technologies so that they couldn't even offer an open internet, even though they're a separate company. So I think that the regime that they have in the UK sort of creates a bit more of a competitive market for internet. So it's really easy to impose that kind of structural separation. Right. You just need good policy.
And so before we let you go, you are an advocate on behalf of media democracy, and we have spoken to you in the past about media democracy. And recently, Ken West actually declared bankruptcy. I was wondering if you could comment on how this might actually affect corporate media concentration in Canada.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's quite telling because, I've been saying that media concentration is a real problem in Canada and arguing that the CRTC needs to basically take some action on this, and basically this problem Ken West is happening is a result of their own greed buying up more than they can handle, and it's a failure on the CRTC's part to actually make sure we have a diverse media system. So now, the end result is there's all these kind of journalists and media workers losing their jobs, and some stations are shutting down and things like that. But I actually think we have a unique opportunity right now where big media is basically in a state of crisis, and they really don't know what to do. They're really out of touch with what audiences want, and at the same time we have an open internet here. We have a growing movement for media democracy and open communications. So. I really think that we have a unique opportunity to reimagine what media is, and what is the dominant media. I think dominant media can be like community and campus radio, and it can be independent online media like the Tai and Rabble and Vancouver Observer and a whole bunch of other projects that I probably don't even know about because they're just springing up everywhere, and most of them seem to be gaining audience share. So my personal opinion is that we need to really seize this moment and support independent media and join and volunteer and do what you can to raise their readership, because I think they can really step into the void here and become, independent media can be the mainstream media if we want it to be.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today, Steve. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Steve Anderson, National Coordinator of SaveOurNet.ca. Now we bring you an update on a story we covered last month. In the midst of the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit, protesters associated with the group Canadian Climate Justice staged sit-ins in MPs' offices across the country. In North Vancouver, five protesters, including a 15-year-old boy, were charged after refusing to leave MP Andrew Saxon's office at the close of business hours. Protesters were critical of the Conservative Party's position on climate change. The purpose of the sit-in was to call on the Tories to commit to a science-based emissions targets and for Saxon himself to defend the Conservative position on climate change at a town hall. Protester Laura Yates explains the group's criticism of Canada's current climate policy.
The Conservatives have spoken a lot about their commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 20% to 25%, which seems ambitious. But in reality, their baselines are set on 2006 emissions levels. So in comparison to greenhouse gas emissions target by other countries and Copenhagen and Kyoto, they were set to 1996 emissions. So the 2006 emissions target, when they're compared to the 1996 emissions target or levels, are only actually about 3% of what is needed and what we want to get back to. So although the numbers sound good, in reality, when you get down and do the math, they're really not ambitious at all and definitely not what we need.
Saxon did not agree to activists' request to debate the issue of climate change at a town hall meeting. The sit-in came to an unceremonious close when five protesters were arrested after refusing to leave Saxon's office at the close of business hours. Yates describes why she believes the decision to arrest protesters was heavy-handed in this case.
Mr. Saxon and his assistants were really just trying to send the message that they didn't want to deal with us. So I feel that the reason that they chose to have us arrested and removed from the office at 5 when some other protests, people had been in the office for, I think, like 10 hours or something, which is obviously longer than office hours. And in other offices, the MPs, if they weren't there, had actually phoned the office themselves and spoken to the protesters. So I do believe that the way that they dealt with us was a message that they were sending to us, definitely.
This week, the climate activists were vindicated as charges laid against them during the December 4th protest were dropped. This is News 101, and the current time is 5:28, and it's now time for your weekend weather forecast. And for that, we turn to Denise. Denise, how is it looking this weekend?
Well, welcome back from the holidays. I hope everyone had a good break. And if you stayed in Vancouver, you had some great Christmas weather, unusually not rainy. Here's your weekend weather forecast for January 8th through 10th. Friday night, we'll see light rain and a moderate mist, low of 4 degrees, due to a low front that moved in the early afternoon. Saturday will be cloudy, with showers or periods of rain, high of 9 degrees, low of 5. Sunday will be mostly cloudy, with some occasional rain and sunny periods late in the afternoon, high of 9, low of 5 degrees. So, bring a jacket for your weekend plans and enjoy splashing. That's your weekend weather, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. For News 101, I'm Denise Diotic.
Thanks so much for that, Denise. As we gently usher in 2010 and reminisce about the major happenings of 2009, we can certainly agree that bailouts dominated popular imagination. While major companies were seeking government aid, CEOs and top-level executives continued to receive bonuses, and an increasing discrepancy between CEOs' compensation and the average income of Canadians grew. Earlier today, reporter Andrew Longhurst spoke with economist Hugh McKenzie about CEOs in Canada.
Soft landing recession in Canada's 100 highest paid CEOs was just published. It's a report that shows that executive compensation has not been affected by the recession that has affected so many Canadian workers. What were some of the key findings in this study?
Well, the headline finding, I guess, is that by shortly after 1 o'clock in the afternoon on January 4th, the second working day of paid day of the year for most Canadians, the average of the top 100 CEOs would have passed the average Canadian in annual earnings, which I think gives you a pretty dramatic indicator of the kind of gaps that have emerged between CEOs and the rest of us. I guess for me, because I've done this for a number of years, the thing that I found. Several things that I found noteworthy about the 2008 report. One is that 2008 covers the beginning of the economic collapse. I think most people would agree that the real economy was starting to weaken as early as the spring of 2008, and when Lehman Brothers failed in September, that really precipitated a huge collapse. And yet, when you compare, when you look at the numbers for Canada's top CEOs and compare them on an equivalent basis, what you find is that the impact of the recession was that they basically lost 1 year of income growth. In other words, in 2008, CEO salaries were about what they were in 2006. They lost the growth that they experienced in 2007. And when you compare that with the kinds of job losses that other Canadians have gone through, it's a pretty significant, I think, indicator of just how resilient the CEO pay machine really is. And the other thing that was interesting about last year on the subject of CEO compensation, and I think underlines the resilience of high pay for CEOs, is that in 2009, for the first time, we really started to, and actually starting as early as the middle of 2008, we really started to see a lot of public commentary from not the usual suspects complaining about excessive pay for chief executive officers. We had at the political level President Obama and European leaders discussed the issue of CEO compensation at OECD meetings. We've seen leaders in what I would call the business academic community really levying pretty harsh criticisms, both at the level of CEO pay and at the way CEO pay is determined. And we also have leading businessmen, like, for example, Warren Buffett, going on at great length about excessive pay for CEOs. And yet, despite that public attention and public scrutiny, the machine just seems to keep rolling along.
I want to continue on that thought. And so from this study, Canada's 100 highest paid CEOs pocketed, this is directly from study, pocketed an average $7.3 million in 2008, and the national average for income of full-time workers is $42,305.
Right.
This is a huge discrepancy.
It's a huge discrepancy.
What's
interesting about those numbers is that when you hear apologists for the amount that CEOs are paid talk, they make it sound as if this is the way things have always been, and that we should just suck it up and be quiet. But in fact, these stratospheric numbers are a relatively recent phenomenon. As recently as 1998, just 10 years ago, the ratio of the average CEO to the average Canadian was 104 times. 10 years before that, in the late 1980s, it was about 40 times. And although we don't have data going back into the 70s, the anecdotal evidence is that it was more like 25 times or less in the 1970s. The other thing that's noteworthy is that the ratios of these extraordinarily high ratios of CEO pay to ordinary people's pay, these ratios are largely a feature of the English-speaking business world. When you look at what chief executive officers are paid in other parts of the world, those ratios aren't anything like the kinds of ratios that exist in North America and in Britain, for example.
I want to ask you talk a little bit about inflation and how the CEO's compensation fared over the last 10 years. I believe that was the set of data from 1998 to 2008.
Since 1998, adjusting for inflation, CEO's pay has gone up by about 70%. whereas the average Canadian has actually lost about 6% to inflation during that same period. So we've got a pretty dramatic disparity there.
70% and to losing 6%.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
That's right.
It's incredible.
So there's pretty good inflation protection happening in some parts of the economy.
Some commentators would say, but Hugh, if you don't pay these CEOs well enough, they're likely to leave Canada. You're not likely to attract the same caliber people into these positions that are competent enough to take on this responsibility of being a chief executive.
There is a point there, and that's one of the reasons why in my discussions is this. I've really stressed that this is not uniquely a Canadian problem. This is a problem that pretty much has afflicted the entire English-speaking corporate world. When people talk about the risk of sort of losing talent, this is not a fake problem. And it reflects the fact that as a wild generalization, I think there are amongst people who are on boards of directors of these corporations, there are some people who really have no interest at all doing anything to stop the CEO pay merry-go-round, because they're benefiting from it themselves. There are a lot of boards of directors. You know, CEOs sit on other people's boards of directors. No CEO who's on a board of directors is going to be particularly interested in taking the lead in trying to grind down CEO salaries, because they're benefiting from the same ridiculous inflation in pay. I also think that there are probably a fair number of people who are on boards of directors who really feel trapped. They look at these numbers and they agree that they're completely ridiculous, and that it's absurd that these positions are commanding this kind of pay. But they have a responsibility to the corporations whose boards they serve on, and they worry that there's going to be a big penalty paid by the first movers.
This sounds like it's a more fundamental problem, though, with our economic structure and with capitalism itself.
I think that one of the things that needs to happen, and it could happen, is for there to be a really powerful catalyst to some change in the corporate sector that can really only come from government. And I think that the discussions that are going on about the need to limit pay in the financial services sector amongst governments are a useful contributor to this. I think that there's actually been suggestions from relatively conservative commentators in the United States that basically say CEO pay is too high, but it doesn't make sense for the government to intervene from a regulatory perspective in the way that boards of directors or corporations pay their senior executives. Governments should simply tax some of it away. And I'm a big believer in that. I think we've basically catered to the interests of very high income people for quite some time in the way that we devise our income tax policy, and we need to do some pushing back. Now, you know, the same kinds of worries about being dramatically different from our neighbors applies here as well, and that's why I think it's important that discussions are going on internationally about corporate governance and the way corporate executives are paid. I'd note that Canada is being about as constructive a player in that debate as it is on the subject of climate change, which you know, sort of doesn't fill one with confidence that Canada is going to play a useful role. But frankly, Canada's not a big player in this. It's the United States has historically been the big source of the big source of energy behind these extraordinary pay amounts.
How many Canadians are aware of the excessive compensation of CEOs in this country, and not only in this country, but in other parts of the English-speaking world?
Well, I think since when I started doing this regular piece of work, I think it's fair to say that it was news to people. It wasn't, not a lot of attention was being paid to it. I think that now, although you know, it still gets a lot of interest when you name it. I think there's a general awareness of the degree of inequality that we're talking about here.
That was Hugh McKenzie, economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and author of a recently published study on the compensation of the 100 highest paid CEOs in Canada. Thanks to Andrew Longhurst for that report. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. We'll be back in just a few seconds.
Do you like having fun and winning cool prizes? Then you got to check out the Sustainability Television 2009 Youth Media Contest.
Sustainability Television and the Sierra Club of BC want your creative, fun, and inspiring poems and essays with pictures or videos describing what you're doing to make your community more sustainable.
There are tons of totally rad prizes to be won. In addition to cash prizes, sponsor prizes include a $10,000 25-day river excursion, a recycled PC laptop, passes to Y Yoga and Sempre Viva Yoga, organic grocery delivery from Spud, as well as visits for you and a friend to Whistler's Zip Trek Eco Tours, and much, much more.
The contest runs until January 9th, 2010. But the sooner you enter, the more likely you are to win. Check out sustainabilitytelevision.com for full details. And tell us what you're doing.
Morning.
Good day to you, sir.
Hey, wait a minute, what the hell?
Getting real tired of you ducking me, man. Yeah?
Oh, my God.
Thank you to all the donors who pledged their financial support during the CITR on-air fund drive. We are moved by your generosity, and thank you for enabling us to purchase new equipment and improve our programming. Do remember to stop by the station, pay your pledges, and pick up your prizes. We look forward to meeting you anytime between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. on weekdays. Thank you again for your amazing response. Listen to our happy voices on the air, happier after we purchase new equipment for our studios. Thanks again.
All right, let's go to the bank.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And that's our program for January 8th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, where you can email news@citr.ca. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Brad Pepink from the entire news team at CITR. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for play-by-play sports right here on 101.9 FM CITR.